Hi, this is Paul Ingram, and this is the PainSci Updates podcast, a members-only podcast of audio versions of my blog posts, which are in turn mostly excerpts from updates and works in progress from my large library of articles and books on painscience.com. For instance, this episode concludes my work on a major rewrite, a large new version of an old article that I used to call A Historical Perspective on Aches and Pains, which for years served as my main explanation for readers for why it's so hard for patients to get good help for pain. Basically because the science and treatment of pain was neglected for decades while medicine had bigger fish to fry, and it remains a backwater to this day. But about a year ago, I realized that the historical perspective, although it had been useful, was only one of many reasons that so many patients with chronic pain are frustrated. 15 reasons, at least. I started working my way through that list. It's been a long road, but now I can welcome you to the third and final installment of my series, explaining the last 5 problems, especially for patients with unexplained pain like fibromyalgia, or more obvious pain that is inexplicably stubborn like frozen shoulder or Achilles tendonitis that drags on for years. I could probably expand the list to 20 or 25, but I need to move on to other projects for now. Before I get going, a trigger warning for professionals. This series is a strong critique of what's wrong with healthcare for pain, and so of course it gets quite negative, and some of these points may be hard to hear. Not all professionals are responsible for all of these problems, of course, and I like to think that my work attracts a better class of clinicians, more comfortable with controversy. In any case, I hope you'll appreciate the insight into how your work might be perceived by frustrated patients. To review first, quickly, just the headlines from parts 1 and 2, the story so far. The first 5 problems were: pain is an extremely hard problem. Number 2, there's not enough good science about pain. Number 3, pain is too easy to ignore and trivialize and blame on the mind, especially in a world full of prejudice. Number 4, a lack of medical leadership. And number 5, specialists aren't very special if you aren't their kind of patient. In part 2, there were 5 more. Number 6 was the opioid war is catastrophic for pain patients. 7, professional pride, tribalism, investment, and the corrupting power of profit. 8, academic and intellectual weakness. 9, rank quackery, icky snake oil, and flaky bullshit. And 10, tech as sneaky quackery. And now in part 3, I will cover the last 5 topics: insurance-based medicine, wellness, biohacking and supplements, the shabby old paradigm of structuralism, a shiny new generation of mind blamers, and finally, pain is a job for a kind of healthcare that barely exists. Despite all the doom and gloom, and there is a lot of it, I will end on a high note of optimism. Okay, so here we go in detail now, the final 5 reasons it's hard to get good help for pain. Number 11, insurance-based medicine. There are many reasons why professionals sell treatments for pain for reasons other than efficacy, but one of the mightiest and worst is because insurance will pay for it. Whole courses of treatment happen mainly because there's insurance money for it. Entire careers can be based on what insurance will cover. It's not always a bad thing, of course, but insurance-based medicine isn't nicely aligned with evidence-based medicine. And that surprises people. Both patients and pros tend to assume that medical insurance companies are so savvy, mercenary, and parsimonious that they would never be willing to pay for ineffective health services. And this is often used as a substitute for scientific evidence. Surely such tight-fisted corporations wouldn't pay for useless treatments, right? Therefore, insured bullshit must work. No, that is not how any of this works. Insurers don't have secret knowledge of the efficacy of unproven treatments. They are not ahead of the science, and you cannot follow the money to what works. If you follow the money cynically, as intended by that expression, it leads elsewhere, like to their willingness to pay for relatively inexpensive bullshit in lieu of much more expensive but effective treatments. But this is all worse for pain patients because there aren't that many treatments that are evidence-based in the first place. Knowledge gaps tend to be filled with snake oil, and then insurance pays for it, legitimizing it and entrenching it. Few things fossilize bad and obsolete ideas as effectively as the flow of insurance money. Number 12, wellness, biohacking, and supplements. Biohacking is an informal term for do-it-yourself health optimization with experimental and often fringe medical practices. I am mostly concerned here with the more extreme examples. Obviously, there is some perfectly defensible self-experimentation with health, but the extreme examples have become very extreme and very common in recent years. Things like nutritional regimens, ketogenic and fasting diets, experimental uses of drugs and hormones, especially nootropics and psychedelics, tinkering with the gut microbiome. But by far the most important thing in the biohacking toolkit, supplements, of course. The single biggest type of alternative healthcare, probably bigger than all the rest put together. People love to hate big pharma, but are surprisingly willing to embrace big suppla, even though it has been every bit as powerful and corrupt as big pharma in the 21st century, while also being virtually unregulated. Big suppla arguably gave birth to biohacking by hard selling us the idea that we can improve our physiology without a prescription from the doctor. And now biohacking is giving back to that industry very generously, constantly encouraging more and more radical experimentation, mostly with what amounts to untested drugs. Some of the best-selling pain pills in the world have always been supplements. Several vitamins and minerals, glucosamine and chondroitin, turmeric, MSM, etc. And they now have roughly the same market share as over-the-counter analgesics like ibuprofen and acetaminophen. And yet, there's barely a shred of credible evidence of efficacy for any of them. Big suppla is injecting billions of untested and poorly quality-controlled snake-oily pills into physical medicine every year, soaking up time and money and attention that is desperately needed absolutely anywhere else. But if biohacking is mainly a grassroots movement devoted to self-care, how has it become a reason that pain patients can't get good help? Extreme biohacking has polluted the whole field, dragging us all towards amateurism, cowboy medicine, and ever more radical health fads. Many biohackers have become extremely influential cranks, extremists, and ideologues who are aggressively normalizing extreme views and ideas. Many alt-med professionals have set themselves up as biohacking gurus and guides and are milking the influencer economy hard. And all this noise gives cover to more mainstream sources that want to profit from sketchier products and services. Stem cell therapy clinics, for instance, are notoriously unethical, racing well ahead of the science, but they now seem relatively tame. Number 13, the shabby old paradigm of structuralism. Structuralism is my word for the excessive focus on abnormal anatomy, posture, and movement as causes of pain, despite abundant evidence that these things don't matter that much. Far too many professionals send patients on wild goose chases to fix things like lazy glutes and pelvic tilts, convincing them that they are like a fragile machine that quickly breaks down when it's out of alignment. It's impossible to overstate the dominance of this way of thinking about therapy. Whole professions are based on it, most obviously chiropractic and massage therapy, which are largely defined by their fixation on fixing bodies with hands and tools, and especially by aligning and straightening them. You can still pay a massage therapist $1 a minute for a bogus postural scan, or a chiropractor, even one of the good ones, to inspect your spine for imaginary glitches. And what makes them one of the good ones? Well, they won't blame your spine for your irritable bowel syndrome. But structuralism haunts the whole industry. All kinds of pain pros are prone to pathologizing every conceivable kinesiological abnormality or variation, from pronation and patellar maltracking to fascial distortions and scapular dyskinesias. One major physical therapy brand is devoted to detecting subtle, injurious movement patterns. There's a crank theory that a tiny foot bone can somehow cause trouble from toe to head. and the most overrated and popular boogeyman in the business is still core weakness, somehow responsible for virtually all back pain, and much more besides. And of course, there are countless claims of disabling tightness in various bits of soft tissue, all of which needs stretching. This is why people fully expect physical therapy to involve many tedious corrective exercises for such problems, almost none of which have ever been useful. Many examples of structuralism are easy to mock, but it can also seem sophisticated. Kinesiology, the science of movement, has churned out countless studies that inflate these ideas, but much of it is pseudoscientific barking up the wrong tree based on very old and simplistic assumptions about the nature of injury and pain. Structuralism is all about blaming things we can easily see or imagine, while ignoring the much messier biology that matters, and even basic but boring clinical wisdom. For instance, load management is often sabotaged by overzealous therapeutic exercise prescriptions. Instead of just resting and progressing slowly, baby steps are the building blocks of most rehab, but it's hard to sell them, and therapists need to justify their fees. And so structuralism is also all about making up problems with solutions that therapists can sell. Number 14, a new generation of mind blamers in physical medicine. Early in this series, I wrote that pain is too easy to ignore, trivialize, and blame on the mind, but that was about laziness, ignorance, and prejudice. Alas, many professionals now also blame the mind much more intentionally and elaborately. They believe that pain is a psychological problem with psychological solutions. And they'll bend over backwards to deny that this is an all-in-your-head diagnosis with a fresh coat of science paint. If patients aren't carelessly dismissed as hypochondriacs, they are taken seriously as hypochondriacs instead. Ironically, much of this is due to admirable efforts to disavow and replace structuralism, which definitely does need to happen. But many well-meaning clinicians have jumped from the frying pan of simplistic biomechanics into the fire of simplistic psychology, pushing mental misalignment instead of physical. It's not your spine that's out of line, it's your mind. At best, the theory has some merit, especially for helping people with suffering and disability rather than actually reducing pain. But even in the best case scenario, this is difficult subject matter to apply. The role of psychology is being extensively distorted and overemphasized in practice, displacing proper diagnosis and treatment. This is often indistinguishable from gaslighting. At worst, yes, worse than that, it's just wrong. Even if the mind does influence pain, that doesn't necessarily mean that we can think our way out of it or be talked out of it. The evidence that the mind has power over pain is a shockingly thin foundation for this allegedly science-based progressive revolution in pain care. There are many examples of passionately held beliefs about the psychology of pain that are extremely dubious. CBT works. Placebo is powerful. Pain can be learned. Boot nail guy is a great example. And many more. I have a pitch-perfect personal example of how this affects pain care. A dramatic experience with my own pain being incompetently diagnosed as a false alarm, when it was in fact a very real medical problem that needed proper diagnosis, which could easily have been achieved by any good diagnostician taking my case seriously. But instead, I was earnestly informed that my overprotective nervous system was just sensitized and there was no issue in my tissue, and therapy was just a matter of learning to calm things down. Countless patients have reported similar experiences to me, and I know that many of them will be cheering for this. I also routinely encounter professionals advocating for treatment inspired by these ideas, and scoffing and circling their wagons when presented with evidence that undermines their beliefs. I'm in a good position to have a strong sense of where the winds are blowing here, and it seems clear that mind over pain ideas are surging in popularity in physical medicine, championed by many popular influencers. It's also clear that it's still dwarfed by the reigning heavyweight champion of structuralism, but it has great symbolic importance because it's being touted by so many professionals as the way forward. Meet the new boss, just like the old boss. Number 15, the last one, at least for now, The alternatives to simplistic biomechanics and psychology are mostly out of reach. I started my career, a long time ago now, criticizing some of the more obvious pseudoscience and quackery available for pain patients, like Epsom salts and homeopathic arnica and posturology. The most common criticism in my inbox ever since has been, "So what does work, smarty pants?" Because a critic isn't credible if they can't replace what they criticize, apparently. But the whole reason that pain treatment is dominated by deeply flawed and simplistic solutions is that there are very few solutions. Providing good help to pain patients requires knowledge, skills, and tools that either literally don't exist at all because we just do not have the science, or they are out of reach of most clinicians for many reasons. One of the more practical examples is diagnosis. A lot of chronic pain isn't actually medically exotic. It's just a needle in a haystack. Those patients need Dr. Greg House, MD, and his whole fantasy team of doctors backing him up. They need a truly talented diagnostician to find that needle. This applies even to many seemingly simpler problems like unusually stubborn tendonitis, which often has metabolic roots, a perspective most healthcare professionals don't know enough to even consider. The existing culture and economics of physical and pain medicine is not prepared for this challenge. The current marketplace mostly offers only simple answers to one of the most complex problems in medicine. The knowledge and skill that are actually needed to do the job are extremely difficult to learn and apply and generally require the tools and culture of medicine and medical science. But then, even more besides that, time, compassion, creativity, intellectual honesty, critical thinking skills, and a big one, healthy economic incentives. But even the minimum involves more education and training than most non-doctors have or can ever realistically acquire, even if they want to. It is not what most of them signed up for. Many just wanted to be body mechanics, not biochemists. Pain is a job for a kind of healthcare that not only doesn't exist, but can't exist without major systemic change. So, can I end on a high note? I originally planned to finish this series with a list of constructive and optimistic suggestions for how to move the field forward despite all of these problems. But this project has been such a beast, so many ideas to wrangle, that in the end I decided to save the positivity for another day. I will try to conclude with one optimistic note, however. What is true of most pain care, no matter how daunting and depressing, never has to be discouraging for individual clinicians. If you're a professional, you can still be a breath of fresh air for your patients. And there is plenty of low-hanging fruit. Clearly, you don't have to go to medical school to be compassionate, respectful, and humble. You don't have to be a genius diagnostician to reject ridiculous theories about the causes of pain. And if you're a patient, you can at least improve your odds of finding one of those professionals. Forewarned is forearmed. You can spot trouble that other patients don't know exists. You can save time and money not chasing wild geese, at the least. And that's my high note. And that's the end of this series, finally, for now. Thanks for listening.